The following is a production of DifferentBrains.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spectrumly Speaking. I'm Becca Laurie, your resident Aspie. I'm also maybe your favorite t-shirt to wear, and I'm also a life coach. I'm joined here by...
Hi, I'm Dr. Lauren Gerber. I'm a clinical psychologist and author of Autism and You. I had a pretty crazy week this week, Becca, because Giovanni, my therapy dog, had surgery on his foot.
Oh, no.
He's in a cast, and he has a big inner tube around his neck so he doesn't bite at his foot.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, no. Who's therapying him?
Everybody who comes into the office is now giving therapy to the therapy dog. Little turn of events here. How was your week?
It was pretty good. I actually had kind of a crazy week of wrapping up all of April. I had taught a class this past weekend, so I was really kind of jumping around. My birthday was this past week, so I'm kind of just getting over it. Thank you. I'm sort of catching up on myself this week. It was a good one.
I'm excited about our guest today. Tell us who we have.
I'm excited too. We have with us today Dr. Kate Cody. Dr. Cody is a licensed clinical psychologist in New York State and Connecticut. She earned her doctorate from the American School of Professional Psychology at Argosy University in Washington, D.C. She is currently in full-time private practice and maintains offices at Spectrum Services in New York City and in Southern Connecticut. Dr. Cody offers psychological and neuropsychological evaluations, including adult Asperger's assessments. She also provides individual and family therapy services, specializing in an individualized and integrated approach to treatment to meet each person's needs. She offers psychological therapy services using cognitive behavioral therapy approaches integrated with social skills and family therapy as needed. Dr. Cody offers particular expertise in therapy for individuals with ASD and co-occurring mental health conditions, i.e. anxiety and depression, etc. She has a breadth of experience working with children, adolescents, adults with ASDs, and she also provides training and supervision to externs and interns in the educational and clinical psychology. Please welcome Dr. Kate Cody. So glad to have you with us today.
I'm glad to be joining you.
Yay. Well, we're a little excited for your interview. I'm excited to talk about some assessment and evals and stuff. I know a lot of people have a lot of questions about it, but fortunately you do a lot of them, so you should have the answers.
Let's hope so.
Dr. Cody, it's a pleasure to have you here today. Our first question for you is, can you please explain to us a little bit about what the adult assessment for autism involves?
Sure. So anytime I'm conducting an evaluation for an adult first-time diagnosis, it really starts with a comprehensive review of that individual's history and doing the best I can to obtain information from a second reporter, whether that's a parent who's still living or a spouse or a relative, because really obtaining that kind of observation information and as much historical information as possible is pretty critical. And from there, I really kind of develop a tailored evaluation plan to meet that person's needs. So it's not just about diagnosis or obtaining a label, but really getting a full profile of that individual's strengths and challenges, and then being able to identify what could be barriers or things that are getting in the way of that person functioning in the way that they would like to. And so the evaluation can really vary depending on the individual. And sometimes it can be on the more brief side, where I'm really doing structured interviews around understanding that person's autism spectrum or Asperger's related symptoms, as well as questionnaires in terms of daily functioning and how that person's kind of range of social communication and behavioral presentation can impact their functioning in everyday life. And then depending on that person's individual needs, it might also include evaluation of intellectual functioning, executive functioning, social, emotional, making sure that I'm not missing anything in terms of possible co-occurring mental health presentations in regards to anxiety, depression, OCD, et cetera. And so it can be as brief or as comprehensive as needed for that individual.
Yeah, it's a complicated process. I'm often asked, you know, how long does it take, or what did you do to get yours, and things like that. And so one of the things I always say, as you could hear from Dr. Cody, there's a lot that goes into an evaluation. So if somebody meets you once for 45 minutes and tells you that you have autism or don't, go somewhere else, because it doesn't happen that quickly.
No, it does not.
For me, when I was going through the eval process, I found a lot of things challenging about going through it and doing the testing. I still say one of the hardest tests I've ever taken, mostly because there was no right answer. And that was difficult for me in and of itself, which I suppose was telling. But what do you find are the most common challenges when you're assessing adults?
I think there's kind of a few things that commonly come up. And one of them is kind of the discrepancy in reporting between the adult themselves and their second reporter. So again, whether that's a parent or a spouse, there's often a pretty vast discrepancy in observations of behaviors. And part of that, I think, can be attributed to kind of significant difficulties with self-monitoring and perspective taking. And so that can impact one's ability to accurately self-report, just because there's a lack of awareness of the impact of certain behaviors. And then I think one of the other things that I find a lot when I'm evaluating adults is many adults have, you know, spent a lifetime developing compensatory strategies and can kind of engage in a lot of really pro-social and adaptive behaviors where they're able to mask a lot of their symptoms. And so that's in part why reviewing the historical information and really gaining an understanding of kind of what this person has looked like throughout the lifetime is so crucial for being able to obtain accurate information. Because just because someone can maybe engage in certain aspects of reciprocal conversation now in their 30s or 40s doesn't necessarily mean that they were always able to do that. And so I think it can be really challenging for evaluators who don't necessarily have that skill set in kind of reviewing the history, to kind of understand how a person's spectrum-related symptoms can kind of evolve over the course of development.
It's a complicated process. I still sit in an area where I really think an eval and assessment is a really important way to go. I know a lot of people are really keen on self-diagnosis, but for me, I wanted a definitive answer. And I know it was a lot of, you know, challenging places along the way to get through the assessment.
Dr. Cody, do you, when you have this initial comprehensive interview and the second reporter, this parent or spouse, somebody who can give you some observation and some historical information, do you have that going on with the two of them in the room together? I know a lot of individuals listening may be wondering, how does this feel to be interviewed about your life? And they're coming in at a point in their lives where they're adults to find out if they have a diagnosis that many people have told them they've probably had for a very long time.
I really empower the individual I'm evaluating to kind of make that decision. And I really present it as a choice. And the majority of adults I've evaluated are actually very comfortable with having the second reporter present in the room. And they experience that as very helpful and actually enlightening for them to kind of be able to be a witness to that feedback and to the information that's shared. But there are times where I present it as a choice and that individual will say, you know, I'd really rather not be present. It's uncomfortable for me. And you know, my goal during the evaluation process is not to increase the discomfort level by any means. And so I'm always, you know, very respectful of what that individual requests or what, you know, what's comfortable for them. And they know that I'm going to get the information, you know, in a separate conversation or a separate interview. I'm very transparent about that, but I'm also very respectful if an individual says, I'm not comfortable doing this in the room with that other person, and that's fine.
So that can put some people's thoughts at ease that depending on their preferences, that can be done separately or together. And mm-hmm. It's just very important that the information be able to be gathered. And even if there's that discrepancy, as you mentioned, between what one reporter says and what someone self-monitoring may believe, that information is gathered and worked with and can help drive both the assessment process and later the treatment planning.
Mm-hmm. I think all of this stuff is so important to everybody. And I really am curious because as we talk about here on the show an awful lot, we talk about the difference, the gender differences that we're seeing in the community and what it's like for women, especially out here. And so I'm curious for you, kind of where does the gender discrepancy come into play? And are you seeing the differences through the assessment? Are you seeing it in the results of your assessment? And how do you feel in the kind of the magic 4-to-1, which is now a magic 3-to-1 ratio?
I mean, I actually was just reading the article this morning about the 3-to-1 ratio. So it's funny you bring that up. But in terms of the way I kind of view evaluation, especially with women, is that I recognize there's significant limitations in our diagnostic measures in terms of accurately assessing women. They were largely developed and normed based on male population samples. And so that means that there are likely, you know, specific symptoms that are spectrum related that are not necessarily going to be captured on those measures. And so I think part of it is, you know, reading current research. Part of it is also having a pretty large clinical sample at this point. But one of the ways that I often view the female experience of being on the spectrum is that so much of it is very internal. And so a lot of my questions become geared around process and that individual's approach to processing social information, processing daily experiences, how they're kind of approaching everyday life. And really kind of tapping into understanding that internal world, because for females on the spectrum, so much of the time it tends to be much more internal, and there tends to be strengths in terms of masking symptoms in social settings. And so I'm very aware of that and really do a lot of probing around that internal process to really gain an understanding of how that individual is experiencing the world and kind of what that looks like in relation to the social communication differences and behavioral presentation related to spectrum behaviors.
Yeah. It's a complicated layering thing. And that's, you know, everybody gets, you know, up in arms about the numbers and our stats and all the things that we're looking at. But the truth is that because the spectrum is just so complicated, when you're doing your evals and you're sitting through them, you know, it's so almost geared to each individual. How are you going to get the information that you need to attain in order to make an assessment? So I love that it's sort of that flexible thing, because that's exactly the flexibility we're looking for in supports and services as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that kind of inherently is a limitation in research is the way we do research is so discrete and so concrete and very like checking these boxes and X, Y, and Z being met. And that unfortunately can limit our ability to understand how females present in terms of their spectrum related symptoms. And I know that there's research that's occurring right now. There's a researcher in DC, another researcher in the UK, and they're really actively pursuing an increased understanding of how spectrum symptoms can manifest differently in females versus males. And they're really trying to kind of take that information to redefine how we inform our diagnostic tools. But right now, I think, unfortunately, the research hasn't yet caught up to what clinicians who really eat, sleep, and breathe this world kind of understand. And so as a clinician, I'm, you know, staying on top of the research, but also having to use a lot of my own clinical samples to inform diagnostic impressions.
How have those clinical samples in your practice assisted you in your testing protocols? I know when I test children, I have children and family in my practice, and we do evaluations. There's a great deal of question having to do with school. So there's a lot of academic evaluation in addition to the intellectual functioning, and then not just executive functioning, but social, emotional, and co-occurring kinds of conditions. But how do the adults that you're seeing, what are they looking for out of the diagnosis? What are they hoping to, and I know you can't generalize person to person, but where are they taking this testing? Who is their audience other than themselves, so to speak, for the report?
So I think that there's kind of a handful of common themes of what brings people in. And one is maybe an individual who is intellectually very intact, but has been really struggling with co-occurring anxiety or depression, and their ability to kind of function in the work environment or function in various social settings has become so challenging for that individual that they really are looking for an increased level of support services. So I would say that's kind of one theme. Another is people who are really just looking to kind of take this and bring it into their therapy and inform treatment planning so that they can have a better understanding of kind of what they need to work on, or how to inform their treatment plan so that they can really effectively acquire the skills that they need to improve their everyday functioning. I think, you know, some people are just curious. I've had, you know, people in their 60s and they come in and they've kind of created a life for themselves that works, but they come in and they're like, I'm pretty sure this is me and I just want to know. And so sometimes it can really vary from person to person, but I do find that it tends to be either service oriented or to inform treatment or just outright curiosity and kind of wanting to understand oneself better are kind of the most common themes that I observe.
Yeah, I know for me, one of the best parts of my evaluation was kind of at the end after it was all done and, you know, my report was coming to me and everything. And with my report, I was able to receive a whole bunch of resources and kind of where to go next and that kind of stuff. And I know that you work with Rebecca Sachs on some stuff, and we've had her previously on as a guest, and I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the treatment planning stuff that you guys talk about in terms of what you're setting up for people after an evaluation.
Sure. So, yeah, Dr. Sachs and I actually just, we spoke at a couple of conferences about assessment-informed treatment planning, and really kind of the way we're seeing it is using an assessment and kind of the different domains of assessment to understand how understanding a person's executive functioning profile or how a person's adaptive functioning skill set, what that looks like and how that needs to be incorporated into evidence-based approaches to treatment. And so what can happen is if you can be an excellent cognitive behavioral therapist, but if you don't know how to modify CBT for working with adults on the spectrum, by kind of taking in this additional data, then we're kind of missing the mark and you might be seeing that there's a lack of progress in therapy or that certain skills aren't generalizing. And so that kind of assessment-informed approach to treatment planning becomes pretty crucial for understanding how we need to modify therapy in terms of implementing interventions. So for example, it might be that we understand that a person has a difficult time with planning an organization, and then how do we support that in therapy so that they're carrying things over? That could be with visual supports, that could be with check-ins between sessions, that could be that we're kind of adding on additional coaching services to support executive functioning challenges. And this is just one example of how we can kind of take the findings from an evaluation and then incorporate that into the treatment planning for therapy and kind of how we modify it accordingly while still utilizing evidence-based approaches to treatment.
So I'm really excited that somebody's actually talking about the post-eval, because we talk a lot and you hear conversations a lot about what gets you to eval, why to go to an eval, what does the diagnosis look like, how long does that take? But there's a little conversation that happens for everyone who gets an eval, or should happen, at the end of your eval where you kind of are given this little, you know, piece and you're able to take it away and it's like, okay, well, here's this and now go do A, B, C, or D. And that's, you know, an important part of getting your diagnosis and not to be left kind of just like, yeah, you have autism. Bye. It's sort of like a really good feeling. And I love that there's now a conversation being started amongst professionals. Like we need to get our game up on how we're going to send people out the door and be prepared to deal with them. And why I love CBT, because this works directly with CBT, is that it really gives you goals and you get to stay very goal oriented in what you're working on. So it's like, okay, but you got your assessment for a reason. What's your reason for getting it? And let's start there.
And then the one thing I think is also important to kind of highlight is when you, so that post meeting is called a feedback meeting. And so during that feedback meeting, you know, the goal is first to kind of understand, really your own profile of strengths and challenges and, you know, associated diagnostic, components that go with that. But really the next thing is to say, okay, well, what do I do with this information? And, what that can really look like is kind of getting therapy recommendations, getting recommendations for additional kind of group services. So that could be working on in a social anxiety group, or that could be participating in a group that is really targeting something that's a specific need for you. So if it's someone who's a college age, maybe it's a college age group, or someone who's at a transition point in life participating in a group like that. It should really also link to any, you know, possible psychiatric recommendations, as well as things like identifying if it's appropriate for that person to be working with a speech and language pathologist for pragmatic communication therapy, and then any additional kind of community-based support. So if there's support groups in the area, it should be connecting the person to that support group or to whatever the local kind of autism spectrum community is. And I the way I view kind of the findings from an evaluation is that a diagnosis is helpful, but mapping out what to do now that you have this information is far more important than just the diagnosis in and of itself.
I could not agree more.
Cody, I'm glad you highlighted the what to do after the evaluation, the idea of the summary section and the recommendations, because many of the adults who come in, as you started with, they already think something's going on and they want to understand it better. So the evaluation portion may solidify for them the various examples and what's going on in terms of their strengths or various challenges. But the recommendation section that says, here's what we have in our community. These are some groups that may be helpful to you. Here is something you could attend. Here are some readings that might be helpful. All of those things, I think, really take the picture and make it a bigger, more full and complete document. And then the connection between the various doctors involved, so the evaluator connecting with the therapist, connecting with the psychiatrist, so that the multidisciplinary team, and as you said, it could include speech and language, it could include PT or OT or ABA, various people, all participating together in a treatment plan and strategizing on what would be most helpful.
Yes, absolutely. And I think even, you know, it's important for the evaluating clinician to have, you know, follow-up contact with the other supporting providers as appropriate. And again, I think this really comes down to kind of understanding what that individual needs and being flexible in an approach to really tailor that, the kind of how you support the next steps.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because there are many next steps. The first year is always, it's interesting for all of us, but we all feel exactly the same way when it's done, which is exhausted. So I thank you very much for your time, Dr. Cody. I appreciate all of your information. I'm sure everybody is thrilled to have heard such absolutely fabulous information. If they are looking for more and they want to find you, how can they find you?
Sure. So you can find me. The best way is via email, which is KatherineCodyPsyD@gmail.com, which is really long, but it's KatherineCodyPsyD@gmail.com. And my information is also listed on our Spectrum Services website, which is SpectrumServicesNYC.com.
Fantastic. We're going to talk about some stuff that's going on in the news now, if you want to stick around for it. It's not really real news because we're going to be talking about Keep the Change, so I hope you'll stick around.
Sure, I'm happy to stick around.
Fantastic.
Dr. Cody, it's a pleasure to have you stay with us for the news. The recent Tribeca Film Festival romance, Keep the Change, just won a number of awards, and we wanted to talk a little bit about it because of its uniqueness. And what it did is it took a New York romantic comedy pairing a Jewish couple on the spectrum, and it was played by special needs actors, which isn't always the case in films. And Becca and I, we were talking about this a little bit, how wonderful that is to see.
Mm-hmm. How completely rare it is to see it. I had the pleasure of being involved in the film since it was a short. It was originally a short film. And I met the director and had actually worked at a conference with her. And she was ready to take it on to be a full-length feature. So and throughout the process, and Dr. Cody was also involved in helping them to fundraise. For us, our local organization, AHA, also supported them in the fundraising. And then we were able to make it into a real deal film. And one of the things that was most important to the director, Rachel Israel, was sort of to make sure she was keeping it real and that it wasn't a story about people on the spectrum, but it was a love story. That was really the idea. And the fact that the people who are falling in love are people on the spectrum was sort of secondary to the story itself. And just that approach was fantastic for me.
It was. I had the pleasure of seeing it also in the short version, Becca, as you stated, and then I saw it at the film festival as well. And it, for me, as a clinician who's been working with this population for over 10 years, the authenticity of the experience for these individuals was just really profound. And I thought very moving, and it made me very hopeful that we can – that this film has the potential to really kind of shift the public perspective of what it is to be on the spectrum, but also what it is to have real relationships as a person on the spectrum, and that doesn't need to be anything any different from what other kind of relationships are, and that that individuals on the spectrum are equally as capable, if not more capable, of falling in love and having empathy and compassion for one another. And the compassion that's really displayed in that relationship is just so beautiful, and there's so much of it that comes across for both of the characters that I'm really excited about the potential for where it can go.
I am too, and it for me, I mean, I had the pleasure really of doing their autism training for the crew before they started, so I kind of was able to be on site and set a couple times, so I saw it along the process, but to actually see it in the movie theater, all I just could say was, it's real, like it felt, you know, all grown up and real on the screen, and I was just so proud of to have been a part of something that I think is so magical. You know, just saying, we don't need neurotypicals to play us. We can play us. Like, we don't, you know, we don't need that. And it's just another kind of shot at, like, hey, you know, let's remove the stigma. It's just another way of looking at the world. And I loved it. And I also really loved, I'm going to talk about it, Lauren. I'm going to give people a glimpse into our sex episode. There is a sex scene in it. And it's graphic enough that it's, you know, shocking a little bit, I think, and it comes up on you unexpected, and I was beyond proud to that Rachel took that really brave step, and that she did it, and that the actors were brave enough to do it themselves, and it was like, yeah, you know, let's talk about it. We don't just want relationships, we also want sex, and if we don't teach ourselves about sex and nobody's teaching us about sex, we're going to find out the way everybody used to find out. And, you know, and that's sort of like how it is. And we get to see that for real on the screen. We get to see it as part of the growth and change of their relationship. And that was so real and tangible for me that I was excited that all of that stuff was in there.
Yeah, it was very authentic. And I was shocked too, because I didn't see that coming.
Me neither.
but it was so well done and so authentic to the experience of many of the adults that I have worked with. I think that the degree of trust that the cast members had to have in Rachel to be open to exploring that on screen is just so – it's tangible when you're watching it, because the performances that they both delivered are just so they're really powerful performance, and they're very authentic to what it is to be an adult on the spectrum. But they're also just very – human and focused on just like, this is who we are as people. And I think that so much of that really is a testament to the relationship that Rachel was able to formulate with the cast members.
Yeah. There was a lot of work on that set to make sure everything was being understood, that people were getting their breaks, that, I mean, it was just a really accommodating, kind environment to on set, and it showed in the film. And Lauren, I cannot wait for you to see this movie. I can't wait, because I know I'm going to get an email. It was so good. It really was one of those.
In reading about it and hearing from the two of you how embedded Israel became with her cast and the acting troupe, and spending over 2 years developing not only the script, but as you said, rehearsing and understanding the genuine needs of the individuals playing the roles in this film, really allowed that love to come through, and the connection, the abundant chemistry that you saw in the film that I'm looking forward to seeing, I think is compelling. So I'm very excited about it. I saw this news article and said, okay, here's another one I have to see. I'm putting it in my list.
Right? I really am. I'm excited. That's sort of a big news here in New York, and hopefully it'll be elsewhere. And I think that's a really exciting conversation to be having. I'm proud of her. Congrats to Rachel Israel and the cast and crew of Keep the Change. They did win both of the award categories that they were in. So they won Best Narrative and they also won Best Director. And so with any luck, someone will get it out into the big movie theaters, which would be nice. Well, I think that about wraps it up for today. Dr. Cody, can you do me a favor and just repeat one more time where people can find you?
Sure. So you can find me at spectrumservicesnyc.com or via email, katherinecodysid@gmail.com.
Fantastic. And be sure to check out differentbrains.com and follow their Twitter at diffbrains, or you can find them on Facebook. You can find me at www.beccalaurie.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook.
And I can also be found on my website, drlaurengerber.com, as well as on Facebook and LinkedIn. And if our audience would please be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, we would appreciate that. And don't hesitate to send us questions. You can reach us at spectrumlyspeaking@gmail.com, and we will answer your questions on our future shows. We're all looking forward to keeping the conversation going. So have a really great week.
Spectrumly Speaking is a production of Different Brains. For more information, visit us at differentbrains.com.